to be here. Zach gave me a great little introduction. I'm a coordinator down abroad in Washington. I don't know if some of you missed that. That's who I am. Glad to be here working with y'all's theme for the season. And got some thoughts to share. Cameron was working right there in the prayer about it's a conversation, so be ready to talk back what you guys are accustomed to, or stand up and shout at me right in the middle of it if it's necessary. All right. So let's start with a story. I was headed up on a mega bus to New York a few weeks ago, and I overheard this conversation that is the inspiration for what I have to say tonight. It was between this little girl and her grandmother. They were sitting like here across the aisle. And let's say her name was Juliana and she was 10. I don't know the exact facts of her demographics. But Juliana was obsessed with iPhones. I know this. Her grandmother had one. She didn't. Her grandfather, who had stayed at home for the day, did not have an iPhone, though he could if he wanted to, and he was crazy for that. I wrote down a couple of things she said in the moment, right there on the bus, because I was so fascinated by her, little Juliana. I went to a birthday party. Everyone had iPhones. I'm ready, Grandma. I'm saving up for an iPhone because I'm allergic to dogs, but I'm not allergic to iPhones. Apple had her. AT&T or whatever other service had her for 2 years at a time, forever. I don't know how she got hooked, but she was hooked. She was so squeaky that I was tempted to hate her for being hooked. Probably just out of annoyance. But luckily I didn't. I didn't even hate her parents, who I was tempted to blame for her iPhone obsession. Actually, I had compassion on them and on her. The forces that run most of the world are often too powerful to resist, I thought in that moment. Actually, I probably more had pity on them, which is a little bit worse, because I thought that I wasn't subject to those powers as well, and she was just a 10-year-old girl, and 10-year-old girls are safe people to be weak, not me. So it's good to have the 10-year-old be the slave and me be the free person. Having pity on them made me feel strong, which is unfair to Juliana and her parents, but also to me. Because if I fool myself into believing that the powers have no control over me, I give the powers more power than they could ever have without my blindness. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. Y'all been talking about true self, false self, and I'm exploring a layer of the false self tonight, consumerism, and what I want to think with Jesus about how to be ourselves in Christ in a world that is constantly striving to define us by our desires and our stuff, and for us to follow suit and define ourselves that way too. Of the quotes from Juliana that I wrote down, there was one that struck me the most. Her grandmother was trying to get her to play a video game, probably to keep her quiet, in respect for me and my airspace. And she said, Juliana said, "No, I don't want to play. I'm just not a video game player, Grandma. I'm not a video game player. I am not a video game player." I'm probably making too big of a deal out of this argument because it's probably just semantic, and those are the words that came out of little Juliana's mouth. But it was the I am that got me. She was defining herself by what she did and did not consume in that moment. I don't know if she does that all the time, but certainly she's being trained to, and I think we do even if we say that we don't. So there are worse things in the world than just being obsessed with an iPhone. Okay, she's obsessed with iPhones. I have an iPhone. I really like it. iPhones aren't necessarily bad. That's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's defining ourselves and being a consumer first that I want to talk to tonight, and I think Jesus can help us do that. the marketers of the world really want us to be a list of preferences and desires to be met and a niche market for each of us. Juliana is more anecdotal evidence to me that our culture's first language is consumerism. It's hard to guard against it, too. My son, Oliver, he's upstairs, he's a toddler, and somehow he became obsessed with Elmo. And I didn't really try to shelter him from Elmo. I don't think people need to be obsessed, need to be sheltered from Elmo. He teaches kids how to count and stuff. But I didn't do it. It wasn't me. I don't know how Elmo got into my house. It was just snuck in. And now I have to buy things with Elmo on it for the rest of my life. Oh, hopefully he'll grow out of it. But our latest purchase sort of is connected to this. We got a potty seat that has Elmo on it, and it makes noises. You can press buttons. It's awesome. So the Sesame Street brand got us. What can I say? I'll confess to a couple other things, too. I define myself, I think, to a degree by the things I have. I was thinking honestly with myself, how do I do this? Juliana's not the only one. For example, I have a shelf in my house. Let me get rid of that. I have a shelf in my house, and I decided, for simplicity's sake, that this shelf I could only have as many DVDs as would fit on this shelf. That is a really good idea. You know, you can only have so many DVDs. I'm going to be a simple person, very noble. But I've realized that shelf is now really important. Like, I really want people to look at my DVDs and see who I am. So they can see The Mission and Amelie and Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, all these amazing movies. But I'm defining myself by these 48 DVDs. I do. And I have my books out. I haven't read all the books, but I want people to know that I have this many books. You know? Gwyneth has read a lot of them. I've read a lot of them. Some of them neither of us have read. But they're all out, and I won't get rid of any of them, even though we don't have enough room. Another thing. I'm wearing New Balance sneakers. And I made sure I didn't wear flip-flops because I remembered I had said this. I wear New Balance sneakers because a while back, New Balance, you could be sure that they were made in America. And then I'd be like, oh, I'm not contributing to sweat labor for my sneakers. And I've seen Michael Moore movies, so I'm going to be a just guy and buy New Balance sneakers. A couple years ago, they moved like most of their production to China, and I'm still buying New Balance sneakers. It's uncanny. I don't know why I do it. And I think that's the point. Or that's the point I'm trying to make. Let's see. So, and I think that I'm getting trained to think this way. I'm just noticing how I am subject to it. And in my confession, you don't have to confess later on, but I'm hoping it's getting in your mind a little bit. Oh, I do this too. And I want us to just start paying attention to that while we're going along here. The marketers are going to great lengths to get inside our heads. I came across this article on the Harvard Business School website. What neuroscience tells us about consumer desire. And that's the sort of technical term that really got my imagination going. Consumer desire is something that's going to be parsed out and maximized. Consumer desire, that's what companies who are selling need to control us. They have to figure that thing out. Let's see. Oh, I didn't put it up. There it is. Yeah. I'm going to read a little bit what's up there, but you don't have to read along. In the early 1950s, two scientists at McGill University inadvertently discovered an area of the rodent brain dubbed the pleasure center. Located deep in the nucleus accumbens, when a group of lab rats had the opportunity to stimulate their own pleasure centers via a lever-activated electrical current, they pressed the lever over and over again, hundreds of times per hour, foregoing food or sleep until many of them dropped dead from exhaustion. Further research found similar pleasure centers exist in the human brain, too. Most humans, fortunately, are a little bit more complicated than rats, but we are largely motivated by what makes us feel good, especially when it comes to our purchasing decisions. To that end, many major corporations, here's the scary part, have begun to take special interest in how understanding the human brain can help them better understand consumers. enter a nascent but fast-growing field called neuromarketing, which uses brain-tracking tools to determine why we prefer some products over others. So neuromarketers here, they've actually debunked another American myth that we have about ourselves, is that we are rational decision makers. What we decide really is the end all. My decisions are important, and they're good ones, and I've thought them out. But really, we're not making those kind of decisions. We're going for what feels good, and we're actually not really paying attention at all. We don't know why. When we're asked why we bought that, these neuromarketers, most of the time we have no idea. At least not some scientific idea. So what the result of that is that it basically says our consumer choices are largely unexamined, unexplored. And again, that's what I'm trying to get us to do for a minute here. Examine and explore those consumer desires. Consumer desire. Here's a couple other articles that topped the list. Google search consumer desire. I like this one because for wine people, the best niche market, like they have these six identifiers for wine buyers, the best one, overwhelmed. That's their technical term for people that we're going to really get to buy our wine. I'm getting overwhelmed. Here's another one. We all like Pinterest. And I just like the title. Pinterest whets consumer desire with images that turn window shoppers into online buyers. Yes! So this is a fact of life, y'all. I don't want to ignore it. I want to pay attention to it. And I want to see what Jesus has to say about it. And I think that he does in a fairly big chunk of the book of Matthew. That's what we're going to do now. We're going to look at this big old chunk of Matthew. And we're not going to look at all of it. It's way too much to look at all of it. Don't even start reading it. If you do read it, like that would be a good thing to do. Read Matthew 15 and 16, that's fine. But we're going to sort of stay at the helicopter level for most of it, and we'll swoop in for a closer look as we go through. When Juliana said, "I am not a video game player," and my heart broke, it was that "I am" that rang in my mind. So when I came back to this problem and was looking to Jesus to help me work with it, I thought of one of his I ams. And he says it down there close to the middle, sort of, when he asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And as I read, I realized that this whole big swath of Matthew pertains to our discussion. It starts up here, where Jesus heals many and then he feeds 4,000 people. He could be getting treated like the one-stop shop for sick and hungry people. See, yeah, there he is feeding the 4,000. Then coming up, the Sadducees and Pharisees come to sample his product, and they demand a sign from heaven. And Jesus warns. Oh yeah, they didn't. Okay, I'm just doing the fly through right now. Yeah, and then Jesus warns them, "Watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees." And they're like, "Yo, is he talking about bread again? We don't have any bread. Shoot!" So they're still not getting it. After that, Jesus asks them, "Who are people saying that I am? And who do you say that I am?" And then Peter gives the sort of climax of the book so far, the climax of the whole book of Matthew so far, is Simon Peter saying, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." It's the first time anybody said that so far. It's a big deal for like the whole scope of the book. And then afterwards is Jesus' explanation of what that actually means. Okay, if I'm the Messiah, let me tell you what that means. And people are disappointed. per usual. All right. Back to the top. So this is the top of there, and these first four sections all work together as a sort of build up to that big event where Peter makes the reveal. The angels at the beginning of Matthew, they're like, "He's the Messiah." Like it has been known through the book that Jesus is a big deal, but no human being had recognized it yet, and that's sort of a big theme throughout all the Gospels is Jesus is revealing himself. And it's kind of a surprise. So when we, with the benefit of 2,000 years of hindsight, are like, come on, Peter, you can do it. You can get there. And then he does, and it's great. But it works out a little bit here. Let's see. Okay, so let me zoom in a little bit here to this one. Oh, no, I already did that. Here we go. Oh, no, I'm not there yet. Okay. Okay, I'm still here. I'm looking right here. I'm gonna read that part to you. It's actually this one. Okay. Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." But Jesus, aware of this, said, "Oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I do not speak about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Yes. So they're still thinking about stuff. We're getting with the disciples here because they have the same problem too. In this case, the stuff is bread. But Jesus is like, "Stuff? I just made stuff miraculously. Why are you still worried about that?" The disciples don't get it. This is often true in all of the Gospels. And if the disciples still don't get it, imagine what all the people who came to the crowd back up at the top, imagine what they're thinking. They're just getting their bread. They're just getting their healing on. They don't even have any relationship with Jesus except for the quick touch. Jesus might even be doing this on purpose. He went up to the top of the mountain, plopped himself down, and said, "Come on, I'm going to heal you." And he's healing people so long that the line, you know, they ate all their bread. They're now it's 2 days later. He's been healing people for 48 hours, and, oh, we better feed these folks. It's kind of like, Jesus, are you trying to be just another a consumable thing? What are you doing, Jesus? But what Jesus is doing is he's demonstrating what the kingdom looks like. He's doing more than just providing needs. The needs are important, and I like what Jesus had compassion on them. He's just responding out of his heart. But it's interesting the way that they might be relating to him, and I think it's a way that we often relate to Jesus too. Jesus is doing what he's doing not just to meet their desires or even their needs. He is demonstrating that he is the one who was sent by God, the Messiah as well. And again, it's this crescendo. We're almost there. We might be getting what Jesus is doing. So when the Pharisees come up, and that's actually, now I'm on track right there. When the Pharisees come up to Jesus and demand a sign so he can prove himself to them, he shrugs them off and points them back to what he's been doing. "Don't you see, Pharisees?" He gives them this cryptic response. "When it is evening, you say, 'It will be fair weather, for the sky is red.' And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to you except the sign of Jonah." That's what I say to your demand for a sign. What? And here's a quick cliff notes, because we're not staying here long. Essentially saying, you're not paying attention to what I'm doing. I'm revealing myself here as the Messiah. Why must I perform for you to believe? You'll get a sign all right, and you won't understand that one either. Side note, when Jesus is saying the sign of Jonah, he probably, most likely, I think it's just a really cryptic thing he's saying, maybe to throw him off the scent. But most likely he's saying it's Jonah was in the belly of the whale for three days. The Son of Man's going to be in the belly of the earth for 3 days. Jonah was in a belly. Jesus was actually dead. So I can't help but see the people who come to Jesus for healing back up there at the beginning as consumers. I think Jesus was playing into that, and he wanted to show people the power of God. And I think we are especially prone to relate to Jesus this way because we are so influenced by our culture. They didn't have as much of a consumer culture back then, so I might be just projecting it back onto the past. What I'm really talking about is if Jesus is healing people and giving out free food, this is how we will probably relate to him. And this is the Jesus we have, is the one that heals people and gives out food. These are the stories that shape our image of Jesus. So we might be relating to Jesus as just another possible thing for consumption. How can Jesus meet my needs? Is he even a good deal? Do the benefits outweigh the costs? Is his bread even any good? I think we often relate to that, and definitely people who have no relationship with Jesus at all, I think that's, like I said, it's the first language of the culture. They probably start relating to Jesus that way. A ton of Christians do too, but I won't even get, almost explicitly do relationship with Jesus that way, but I'm not going to get into that. And so I can't help but see the Pharisees and the Sadducees as the religious connoisseurs. We've got the mass consumers, and then you got the religious connoisseurs coming up and sampling the delicacies. They've got their preconceived notions about how God is expected to show up in the world, and so they want to come and decide whether they like it or not. We're not sure if you're really that great. You might be too spicy. We may be prone to relate to Jesus this way too, so expectant of how we want God to show up, and that we don't actually see the amazing stuff that God's doing right in front of our face. But that stuff that God is actually doing, it's probably not the right stuff. It's not the stuff we prefer. It's not doesn't meet our quality requirements. I wonder. I would never love that kind of Savior. Not nearly enough bouquet. And then the disciples. There they are down here at the bottom again. They're so close to getting it. And then they do. Oh, I didn't even put a slide for that. Should be like a big exclamation point. This is what Jesus was going for. He wants them to know who he is. He wants them to get it. And Peter functions as the spokesperson for all the disciples. And I'll read I do have a slide for that. That is the slide. This is the climax, like I said. Why didn't someone else read that for me? Anybody? Go ahead.
He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven."
So Peter identifies Jesus correctly, and in return, he gets identified. This is probably the main thing I want to say. It's the main thing that I think we need to hear tonight. It's best when we are identified instead of choosing our identity. When we meet Christ for who he is and it finally sinks in, which is the miracle of faith, we are identified as Christ's church. And that comes with a lot of power to prevail against the evil that is prevalent in our world. Evils like consumerism, evils like obsession with iPhone and defining myself by whether I play video games. When Simon called Jesus Messiah, he got a new name, Peter. Our transformations are equally dramatic. I've known some people that have even taken a new name as a symbol of their transformation. I think it's a good thing to do, because then all hell can't even stop us now. But hell is sure as hell gonna try. Back up close to the top, when Jesus is talking about the weather and the signs of the times, he's encouraging us to pay attention to what's going on. Not only is Jesus still at work in the world, but evil is still at work too. Our generation is still evil and adulterous, as Jesus put it. And one of the signs of our times is the corporate powers that conspire to trap us and Juliana. So one more biblical digression before I wrap up here, because I think that Jesus brings one more thing to our attention that I think will help us in sort of responding to consumerism and responding to this transformation. What does it look like? And it's actually back in Matthew 12. Sorry. We were doing 15 and 16. Now we're back in 12. Just because when the Pharisees and Sadducees come up to Jesus and are like, yo, give us a sign, it's like a rerun of another run-in that Jesus had with religious leaders. It's like the exact same thing. They come up, hey, give us a sign. And Jesus comes back at him, I'm not going to give you a sign. I'm just going to give you the sign of Jonah. It's like a redo. But Jesus is a little bit more cryptic in the Matthew 12 part. And he talks about the Queen of Sheba. And it's really cool. It's like apocalyptic and like don't really understand it all. And this one's probably pretty prone for misunderstanding too. But I think I got a handle on it at least a little bit to help us out tonight. So let me read this. When the unclean spirit has gone out of a person. Oh, yeah. So it's this evil and adulterous generation. And he's like, he sort of gets on a tangent. Okay, so what evil is at work in the world? And he's talking about demon possession. Sort of in going down that rabbit hole. And he says, when the unclean spirit has gone out of a person, it wanders through waterless regions looking for a resting place, but it finds none. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. When it comes, it finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and brings along seven other spirits, more evil than itself, and they enter and live there, and the last state of that person is worse than the first. So will it be also with this evil generation. So I don't think this means y'all are really going to get it. It doesn't mean that. I think Jesus is saying something about the nature of evil power within us. You can't just clean out the house, leave it vacant, and expect that the abundant evil in the world won't move right back in. You can't, for example, make some really wise decisions about cutting back your consumer spending because you don't like being dominated by the corporate powers and not address the desire behind those actions. This isn't simply about behavior. You have to fill the vacant house with desires that are good, with Jesus himself, and with a life of discipleship, I think. That's Jesus' answer. Because back there at the beginning, oh, I don't know. Oh, that's preview. Oh, there it is. All this part, it's about discipleship and about how freaking hard it is. But it's a worthy cause to fill up your vacant life that has been freed from the powers of sin and death, one of those being consumerism and its power over us. So back to this. Here we go. This is where Jesus makes it. He sort of shows his true colors. Okay, I'm not really something that can be consumed. If anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves. That is not a good selling point. And take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? The selves that we have created based on the stuff and preferences and desire and probably a bunch of other stuff, that false self we've been talking about for weeks here at Frankfurt and Norris, it needs to be lost. I think the church spent a long time really getting into the whole deny thyself thing. And maybe we as modern inheritors of a new sort of church have thrown that ascetic baby out with the bathwater. So the deny thyself thing doesn't really ring true to us, maybe we might say. But Jesus is saying, in response to, I'm the Messiah, this is what it looks like, it's kind of plain and clear, this is what your life needs to be. If not, you're just going to get your house full of demons again. You got to do something with your life that's going to keep you free. You're not just, it's not just like a force field, it's a life that I'm offering you. So, asceticism can go overboard, obviously, but and asceticism is like denying yourself, essentially, as a spiritual discipline. It can go overboard, but we don't need to, I already said that. Denying ourselves is something Jesus tells to do, and I'm imagining how we can take him on his word, and I think I found a few ways that we're already doing it as a community, this is just a couple ideas for how to keep encouraging each other to do it, keep calling each other to actually live that life. First one, this is a preview that I had. Tithe. What better way to confront any of the money-exhorting corporate powers that dominate us than to give our money instead of to them, but to this body, the church. Sometimes I look at my friends' discretionary spending. I look at how they spend their money, and I'm like, man, they have a lot of good stuff. And they do a lot of fun stuff, too. Why don't I get to do those things? I can't do them. And it's like, oh, yeah, 10% of my income. But I'd rather give 10% of my income than have my house full of 8 demons. And I'm serious there. I really think that I've been saved from many demons because of my faithfulness in that area. That's one that Gwyneth and I, we just cut it off the top. It's not even negotiable. Like, if we forget to pay in June, we'll pay double in July. But as a result, I can't buy as many Chipotle burritos. Speaking of Chipotle burritos, we can fast. This is a very literal denial of self, and a lot of us do this around the time of Lent as we're preparing for resurrection, and that's a good time to do it too. But I wasn't really hanging out with her because she lives in Puerto Rico, but she was one of my, I was working for MCC this summer, and she was one of my people that was like in this internship program, and she was telling me about her prayer life and her regular fasting life. And it just seemed like in Puerto Rico, that's like common thing to do among their Mennonite church. Yeah, oh yeah, we fast all the time. It's like, oh man, we only fast at Lent. Maybe we should try that. I'm sure many of you fast more often than that, and fasting is something that you know, Jesus tells us explicitly to do sort of secretly. You're not fasting so everyone can see you fasting, so maybe you're doing it. But I think it's a good way to get our body and our heart together to get that get the desires sort of lined up, because we're not even paying attention to them, so we might as well start paying attention to our belly desire, and maybe they'll start rolling. I found that in my life, discipline begets discipline. So if I can get maybe appetite begets appetite, if I can get an actual belly hunger going, maybe I can get a spiritual hunger for God going too. That's the idea. It's worked for me sometimes, but I'm preaching to myself too. Last one. One of the big commodities that we have is time. We're all way too busy, it seems. And we have to really carve out our appointment with God so that we can get next to Jesus and kindle that desire. Because it's hard to follow Jesus. He's telling us that we might have to lose our whole life to gain our life. We're going to have to address this all this false self that we've been looking at. I'm sure it's emotionally difficult for many of us, but even physically difficult sometimes because we don't have enough, or we feel like we don't have enough. So getting into a regular discipline of time of prayer is another way that a lot of us do that. There are resources you can use, the daily prayer. I was up at 1 o'clock this morning. I was working at the hospital, and the daily prayer came through, and I was like, oh, bedtime story, because I get it on my email, which is good, because then I have to read it. I'm not allowed to delete the daily prayer. This is my discipline, you know? So I'll say it one more time in wrapping up here. I think this is hard. I don't blame Juliana for being such a dominated little 10-year-old, because I'm a dominated 29-year-old. And I think if we admit that, we can get protected instead of being stupidly powerful, because we're not. We have this image of ourselves that that the 7 demons aren't coming to get us. But Jesus is going to be there. He promises that he will. We have to like do it with him. So let's not get run around by consumer desire. Let's pay attention to it this week and ask Jesus, bring it to Jesus. Yo, I did this weird thing. What do you think, Jesus? And I think that he'll have something to say. So let's get started on the praying now. Jesus, thank you for this time to think through way too much of the Gospel of Matthew. Help us to find time to study it more and to have it reveal even more stuff to us. Have you reveal it, who you are, again and more, each time we go to Scripture, and each time we talk about it with our friends and in ourselves. Keep this conversation going. Keep it going right now as we're going to do some talk back. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So y'all got anything to say back to that? Any stories or any questions?